Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
From Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And from Granite State College, offering diverse bachelor's and graduate business degree programs online. Designed to help working adults advance. Granite State College, where quality matters. More information and registration at granite.edu.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. The debate was long, but the New Hampshire Senate did something the New Hampshire House couldn't do, which is pass a state budget. But the House did pass several Republican priorities this week, a fetal homicide bill, a tightening of proof requirements for residency for voting, and a bill to clear the way for towns without public schools to use tax dollars to send students to private ones. And oh yes, we're going to talk about those Bears and Governor Sununu. Lots to discuss this week on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, joined by Allie Morris of the Concord Monitor, Jeff Feingold of the New Hampshire Business Review, and Dean Spilotis of Southern New Hampshire University. Good morning, all. Why don't we start with the budget in the Senate? It took 10-plus hours of debate, but the Senate has put the bill back in the House's court after passing a $10.8 billion plan along party lines. You were there, Allie. What should people know about what's in this package at this point?
Yeah, well, I think something noteworthy to point out is though they did meet in a 10-hour session, this plan changed almost nothing from what the Senate finance writers had initially written. The session was a lot of Democrats trying to boost spending for everything from mental health to child protection to higher university, higher education funding, and they were unsuccessful in all those efforts. So I think notably what this includes is another round of business tax cuts. I think that is trying to woo over some of the conservatives in the House who maybe weren't amenable to the plan they had in their own chamber. And it does spend to boost services for mental health at a time when the system is really in crisis. We've seen people waiting in emergency rooms for days or weeks to try to get a treatment bed at the state hospital. So I think Senate budget writers were trying to boost services in areas where they felt the state really needed it. And also cut taxes to try to appeal to some of those conservatives. Obviously, the budget does not appeal to Democrats who say it doesn't go far enough.
Now, these tax cuts are sort of over the horizon. They don't take effect until 2020. Jeff, I'll ask you about business tax cuts. I'm sure businesses will take them, but is it fair to say they're seeking them at this point?
Well, actually, there wasn't really too much of a drive for these. The first round that was passed last time out, they were eagerly looking for them. But the agenda of many business lobbyists, and I'm talking about basically the Business and Industry Association, some of the others, was not so much getting more tax cuts because the tax cuts, there are tax cuts, even if this doesn't pass, that are already scheduled to happen. These just cut them a little deeper. But the discussion has also been on various other issues alike, especially things like education. Workforce development is number one on the agenda right now. There's major concerns about having an adequate workforce now and in the future. So that involves a lot of the education. Community college system got some extra funding, but they had really tried to get the university system to get some more money. And apparently the Senate said no, they just flat fund the university system. So that was a big concern. Infrastructure spending was also a big deal. And there's some infrastructure spending here, but it's not quite the amount that I know that people in particularly in the construction industry wanted. There are other things there that there was more of a big picture feeling about what the agenda was for business lobbyists this year. You know, they'll take those tax cuts like you said, but in the end, you know, there are other things they wanted that aren't really in the budget at least at this point.
The trade-off between job training and tax cuts is something we've talked about for a while. If you remember back to Governor Hassan's budgets, she often had money in there. I think she called it her innovation job training plan. And so, you know, it's not unusual for Democrats to focus more on pumping money into job training programs and opposing these kinds of business tax cuts. You remember Governor Hassan vetoed the first round of tax cuts that you mentioned. These are supposed to reduce revenue by about $100 million over the length of the cuts. They are in the future. I think that this is something that may appeal to Republicans in the House, but there are some in the House who also believe that even despite the debate we just saw in the Senate between Democrats and Republicans over social program spending level, who believe that it still spends too much. So we'll see what happens when this goes to the House and then, I assume, to a conference.
Yeah, but the interesting thing, historically there have been, aggressively trying, business and industry associations have been aggressively trying to get these tax grades down because they've been arguing that New Hampshire has the highest business profit tax, business tax in the region, and they, as you said, this is not a bad thing for them, but they had other things on their agenda, and like you said, historically Democrats have been behind job training, but this is not the case this year. I mean, at least the last couple of years, really, because that is a major concern of businesses in any industry you can name, where there's a need for skilled, trainable workers. And it's just kind of getting a little – they're nervous right now.
Well, I mean, you can certainly discuss the tactical implications as the budget completes its transit, or at least it's hoped it completes its transit, of the business tax cuts. But the kind of hangover from the prior debate over business tax cuts and – collections have been up above estimate. The argument from critics, including Governor Hassan and Democrats, was this was going to blow a hole in budgets, and that was the hang up in the last budget. Collections are up, and opinions really differ on whether it's correlation, causation. You raise that question and things can get pretty heated. Senate President Chuck Morris has been pretty insistent that more good things are going to come out of these business cuts, but it may be telling them they didn't choose to do them right away. So the implications will be down the road. And, Democrats have talked about in the House maybe, trying to lean on Republicans to get a trigger, sort of a circuit breaker mechanism, which was put in several years ago when Republicans dropped the tobacco tax. That's down the road. But, it's certainly mentioned that one potential selling point for the budget among critics in the House would be these business taxes. And why don't we take a listen to what one of the leading conservative critics of the budgets this year in the House, J.R. Hole, said. He said he considered these business tax cuts a starting point, but still has problems with this budget.
Mathematically, if I look at the handout from the Senate, okay, in general and education funding from 2016-17 to 2018-19, that is a 5.48% change. The budget still spends more than I am comfortable with, and there are others who share those views.
Okay, that was Dunbarton Republican J.R. Hole, member of the House Freedom Caucus. Obviously, several dozen of those folks really did lead the way in scuttling the House budget. Ali, he was obviously talking about general fund dollars, and the whole general fund versus federal fund issue is something that comes up in these budget debates. But do you get the sense that those fellows are just, and I guess it is mainly men, but there are some women in the group, that they want a bottom line, and that's their concern, and it pretty much ends there. And if they don't get that bottom line, then we're going to have a similar dynamic as this moves along?
That's certainly what they're laying out at this point. And I think it will be really interesting to watch how Senate and House leaders try to negotiate, if they do, with the House Freedom Caucus to try to reach a bottom line number, just because that's not the way that Senate budget writers and House budget writers have crafted budgets in the past. And, I've talked to some Republicans who are a little frustrated that, just saying no, they say, is not the answer. You can't just say no and get what you want. And so I think that sets up kind of an interesting dynamic going in. But I think it's worth pointing out, this Freedom Caucus has about 30 members. They had a meeting this week, and that's what members say, how many people showed up. And given the small margin of Republicans in the House, that group could make a huge difference when it does come to the budget. And if they don't reach that bottom line number, I think people are worried that nothing will pass and the state will potentially face a continuing resolution over the summer. That's certainly something people in the State House are chattering about at this point.
When it raises the specter that House Republicans may need to cut some sort of deal with at least a portion of the Democratic caucus in order to get this thing over the line. And, you know, is it obvious at this point what sort of policies there could be agreement on other than just some sort of institutional let's do the best we can? And as Ali says, the specter of a continuing resolution, which at best would basically level fund, and the budget as proposed by the Senate would, you know, increase funding for a lot of areas of concern for Democrats.
Yeah, I think that really at this point it seems the easiest road, or the path of the better road for the Speaker is to start talking with the Democrats, because apparently if you listen to Representative Hall and his fellow like-minded Freedom Caucus members, they seem very well very comfortable in just continuing to say no on this, and I think they like the idea of a continuing resolution.
Yeah, it could be, as you mentioned, Josh, some sort of safeguard or safety valve on the tax cuts to make sure that they're paid for. It could be more money for mental health and social services.
Perhaps the university system. I mean, that would be a big one.
Sure. Kindergarten. We can talk about the kindergarten bill that just went through the House. Things like that.
But, I mean, the politics also are a little bit different this year in that we don't have divided government any longer. So this is something where, you know, Republicans, you know, they control Concord. You know, in some ways you could view this as their budget. The political implications of failure may be higher for them. Certainly Governor Sununu would just as soon have a budget pass. But, you know, it's also clear if you look back to the last budget when Governor Hassan vetoed it, you know, that was considered kind of a politically risky move at that time. And there were a lot of factors at work in the 2016 election, but there's no indication that that hurt her. And
she's in Washington right now, isn't she?
There does seem to be a potential, you know, may have hurt her in the building a little bit and built some ill will with people inside the State House. But, you know, there is a sense that that, you know, when it comes to budgets, they're very important to people in the building, and they're very important to people who need services out of those budgets. But to the average person, you know, crisis over a budget can still seem pretty remote.
Yeah, it is basically inside baseball for the most part. And you know, it's very important, though, the state budget. You know, people might not think about it every day, but it's very important. But, you know, this is true. But in terms of having to get, if you have a continuing resolution going, there are going to be some needs that are very much in the news, and that would definitely be led by the opioid crisis. And this puts a lot of money into that, and also the mental health system. And that those are things that are definitely people are aware of. And I think if it's the status quo for any extended period of time, and they'll say, well, look, we could have done something better, but we didn't raise the money. We're still on a continuing resolution. We don't have the money to increase enforcement.
Well, that
or whatever.
Is one factor that people close to Republican leaders have indicated that they feel will kind of count in their benefit. That, you know, the growing cadre of lobbyists and people showing up to testify on bills regarding mental health and substance abuse, you know, those folks want the increased funding that is in this budget. That sure they would like more, but you know, if it's a choice between what we have and what may be coming, that, you know, that sort of pressure will build on Democrats. But, you know, there are also, you know, we talk about divides in the Republican Party. There are divides in the Democratic Party. I know you've written about this some, Ali. I mean, do you see that playing out in a significant way as the votes need to be counted to get a budget through?
Yeah, well, I think when I covered some splits in the Democratic caucus in the House, there were two factions. I think some Democrats are fine sitting back and watching Republicans implode, which, you know, very well could happen if this negotiation doesn't happen among Republicans. But some Democrats are, you know, of the point, hey, we have a lot of cards here. If House Republicans can't work with this Freedom Caucus, we can come to the table, try to put some of what we want into this budget, and then pass it, which would help our constituencies. I'm not sure whether discussions have gotten that far yet. I've spoken to some members at the State House who say they haven't really been looped in on who might be put on the Committee of Conference once it's requested, which I think will be a big sign to show which direction these negotiations are going. But I think it's still pretty early in the process, and some of those negotiations are ongoing.
I think that is true, but it's the case, as we've talked about before here, that when you have unified government, you very often see factions emerge in the majority party in the legislature because they feel like, you know, now it's our time to be true to our principles, to put forth the agenda that we want, and you run into a lot of trouble, certainly at the presidential level, but also at the state level. There's something about the dynamics of being in the opposition that leads itself to a bit more cohesion than what you typically see in the majority party.
And what Governor Sununu's role is going to be in this is also something that's going to be interesting to watch. You know, how deeply he gets involved. I mean, there's I'm sure you've heard the same indications, Allie, that you know, when you talk to Republicans, they say, well, you know, at the end of the day, Chuck and Sean and Chris get along well, and, you know, they're going to come to some sort of understanding. And, you know, perhaps that will be the case. And, you know, another thing to consider is, as we move into the Committee of Conference process, is, you know, right now the attitude is that the House's failure to the budget isn't going to significantly hamstring them in terms of negotiating positions with the Senate. And, you know, maybe that'll turn out to be true. But it's also true that, you know, the tribal nature of these committee of conferences between the chambers can get pretty heated. And on sticking points, it's not hard to imagine that the Senate's going to be like, well, guys, you know, you don't have a budget. This is what we're doing.
Yeah, it's good because we are pretty much in uncharted territory now, and it'll be interesting to see how this happens. And, you know, that committee of conference will be quite interesting to watch to see what's going on, because this is really what is the House's negotiating stance on this? What are they going to be saying? Well, this is what we voted on. Well, you did. You know.
Tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477. What are you hoping for the end game of budget negotiations, and what do you make of other goings on at the State House? Once again, the number is 1-800-892-6477, or find us on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Joined this week by Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University, Allie Morris, Concord Monitor, and Jeff Feingold, New Hampshire Business Review. You know, the budget isn't the only, you know, game in town. And this week, there's been a lot of activity at the State House. A lot of bills that Republicans wanted to pass have passed. We can start with Senate Bill 3, which tightens standards on proof of residency for voting. That got out of the House on a 191-162 vote. Some had expected this to be tighter, as some Republicans were concerned the proposal didn't go far enough. I think the final tally was that 2 Democrats in the House supported and a dozen or so Republicans and Libertarians opposed. You know, Governor Sununu greeted this by saying, as host of the first in New Hampshire nation primary, New Hampshire has the obligation to ensure our system is beyond reproach. This bill does exactly that. And, you know, beyond reproach is an interesting thing to say. You know, recall he kicked off this year's election law debate calling for the elimination of same-day registration and invoking busloads of Massachusetts voters, Dean.
Yeah, this is an issue that has been kind of going back and forth in the state legislature for some time now. It really picked up steam with Bill O'Brien back in 2010 in the O'Brien state legislature, and the push for the need to show a driver's license. And then some of that was rolled back, and now we're moving towards stricter laws again. You know, this is an issue that Democrats will continue to complain disenfranchises some voters, that it's designed to target college students who vote increasingly Democratic, and other transient campaign workers, et cetera. Some people argue it's, you know, based on fear of voter fraud that there's no actual empirical proof for. But Republicans say that it's a pretty, as you mentioned, sort of a pretty reasonable standard to prove that you deserve to be voting in New Hampshire. You know, these kinds of things often end up in the courts based on a civil rights violation, voting rights violation. We'll see what happens with it. But it's the difference between having a Republican and a Democratic governor.
Yeah. Well, it is part of the national effort. It's been going on for many years now among the Republican Party, across the country. And we've seen even more onerous bills
in other states.
In other states,
much stronger. Yeah.
So New Hampshire, in some respects, is being mildly going along, but it's still a sticking point, and it does kind of raise a red flag to a lot of people.
Well, and whether this kind of cools down this debate or just fosters more is something that I'm interested in watching. I mean, during the floor debate yesterday, one rep was saying, you know, let's not let the perfect be the enemy of the good kind of argument. And he said, well, you know, you can't boil the ocean, which is something of a memorable turn of phrase I don't think I've ever heard on the House floor before. You know, I would expect, you know, Republicans, a lot of them don't think this goes far enough. Whether Governor Sununu continues pushing for things now that this is, you know, headed to his desk is going to be something interesting to watch.
Yeah, because he could basically say mission accomplished on this. Let's move on. We've got other, you know, bigger fish to fry in that ocean. So, If you didn't like that one, did you, Josh?
Well, it's hard to fry them by boiling, as far as I know. But in any case, you know, consider this, as you say, an indication of what Republicans in control have conquered. A result of that. We'll be back after a short break. More of the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. This is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Joined this week by Jeff Feingold, New Hampshire Business Review, Allie Morris of the Concord Monitor, and Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Let's go to the phones. Rick is calling from New London. Good morning, Rick. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well.
I was wondering what your guest thought. I have I'm calling from the Flying Goose Brew Pub. I'm the brewmaster here, and I have, while it's not as shiny a bill as, say, a budget bill, we have HB 353, also known as the Growler Bill, which would have taken the growler filling out of the hands of brewers and beverage manufacturers and given that ability to retailers. I'm wondering if your guests have any opinion on that.
Well, I believe my understanding is that bill's been tabled. Is that your understanding? It sounds like you've been following this, Rick.
I have been. As of yesterday, it appears as though it was tabled, but this is probably the third time that they've tried to pass this particular bill, and it kind of went back and forth this time around with different amendments made to the bill, and then it appears as though it's been tabled. So I'm just wondering if your guests have any opinion on that. And again, I realize it's not.
Yeah, I mean, this hasn't been something I've been focusing on, but I'm curious for your opinion on something. You know, obviously the state and proponents of pieces of legislation have liked to say that New Hampshire has become a better place for people who brew beer and that there have been, you know, various relaxation of standards. You know, do you feel that that the state is moving in a direction that makes your life easier as somebody in the brewery business?
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah, we have a very good relationship with the Liquor Commission. We just actually went over all the rules and regulations with the commissioner with the Liquor Commission, and hopefully they'll be coming out with a summary of what those talks, you know, came to. I would say our state's pretty good about liquor laws here. However, this particular bill, I don't want to hijack your show with this bill about filling growlers, but we were not in particular bill, and
all right, well, got it, Rick. Let's so, Allie, what do you know about this bill?
Well, he's right. This has come up a number of times. And, you know, I think it goes to, there have been a flurry of bills in the last few years to try to loosen restrictions for people who do brew their beer, for wineries, to make it easier for people. It was becoming a new craze to kind of go and enjoy maybe food or drinks at places where people actually make beer or wine. And I think this is tricky for a state like New Hampshire that does control the sale of liquor and wine, just because those two issues kind of go at odds. And I know I've talked to some lawmakers who've talked about potentially looking over our control state statutes and seeing where it could be relaxed. But I think one of the big tensions here is that we as a state profit off of liquor and alcohol and control it. And so when these bills come through to try to loosen those regulations, there's
a turf
always
issue.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and just to put it in perspective, there's been a big boom in the brewing industry in New Hampshire over the last several years. You know, Flying Goose is an example of it, but there are dozens and dozens of breweries.
Well, micro and nano.
Yeah, micro and nano breweries. And you know, some of them are very, very successful or become very successful. And you know, they see it as a way of like kind of making it giving a little more impetus to this industry to grow.
Well, and how you have a brewery that doesn't become a bar is something that I know the state has been concerned with. And
yeah,
you know, you can buy a certain number of small glasses
right.
of
yes.
beer, but you can't really have a full fledged pint of beer. And you know, that sort of
yeah, just anyone who takes a brewery tour, you know, any of these places, like if you go to Smutty Nose or one of these places, that's how they have it there.
All right, well, let's move from growlers to some other issues that were before the House this week. You know, we talked about the Senate Bill 3, the residency standards, proof tightening. You know, two other big bills that were real priorities for Republicans also passed in the New Hampshire House yesterday. One was a fetal homicide bill, which allows a fetus after 20 weeks to be considered a person in cases involving murder, manslaughter, and negligent homicide. You know, in some ways you could look at this as, you know, relatively pedestrian policy. New Hampshire would be the 39th state to essentially adopt a variant on this law. But in other ways, a very big deal for folks on both sides of this issue. Why is that, Allie?
Yeah. Lawmakers have been trying for a number of years to pass a fetal homicide bill. And the hang-up has actually been typically Republican infighting. And so they've been proposing this bill because a number of women have actually come forward. They've been in car crashes mainly, or other accidents where they've been almost to term and they've lost their unborn baby and were not able to pursue specific charges for that loss. And so Republicans have been pushing this bill for a number of years. They say it gives women justice who do lose babies. But they've never been able to agree on at what stage in fetal development this should take effect. The Senate actually proposed at viability. The House had actually pushed for 8 weeks or even at conception, and we got 20 weeks out of this bill. And what critics say is that this could put the state on a slippery slope of giving a fetus rights that pits those rights against the rights of the mother. And they warn that in other states, fetal homicide bills have been used to force pregnant women to get certain medical treatment, including cesarean sections, and made those concerns known. However, Governor Sununu has said he plans to sign this measure.
Why don't we listen? Because, I mean, this has both sides will tell you that this has become, you know, a proxy for a debate over abortion in some ways. I mean, why don't we listen to what Governor Sununu said? And this was back after he was elected, but before he was sworn in, talking about things he wanted to happen in the state.
I would love to see a fetal homicide bill done. I think that protects women who have been violated and lost late-term pregnancies. I am pro-choice. I believe in a woman's right to choose the best path forward for her and her family. That doesn't conflict.
Right, that was then-Governor-elect Sununu talking about fetal homicide back after election, before being sworn in. And he says he says there's no conflict between supporting, you know, a law that grants some degree of personhood to a fetus and supporting a woman's right to choose to terminate a pregnancy, Dean.
Yeah,
do many people walk that line so far?
Yeah, you know, you heard him in that clip use the phrase late-term pregnancies, and the big debate among Republicans has been over, you know, what's the threshold? Is it at conception? Is it 8 weeks? I think this current bill says it's 20 weeks. And so there's always a debate about, you know, viability, about you know, what the time frame should be. Reproductive rights organizations, as Ali mentioned, are very concerned that this, you know, even though we sort of understand sort of the tragic nature of a lot of these car accidents where pregnant women lose their babies, that despite that this potentially in other contexts can be used as kind of a way to push back against reproductive rights. So as you mentioned, you know, we're going to be one of almost 40 states that have this. And, you know, he is sort of walking a fine line. Some, you know, pro-choice Republicans are often in the position of having to do that. So it didn't surprise me. But the key is he mentioned that phrase late term pregnancies, which is sort of the more sort of moderate.
Well,
the issue.
The history in New Hampshire on this is kind of interesting. I mean, back in 2009, I believe, Attorney General Ayotte suggested that the state review statutes after there was a Supreme Court case that said a fetus that I believe was 7 months old couldn't be a homicide victim because the fetus was not born alive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was a bill in 2012 that made it to the governor's desk. Governor Lynch vetoed it. That set the date of personhood at 8 weeks.
Yeah, it was much earlier.
You know, in 2015, as Ali mentioned, there was a fight between Republicans over when that, what number that should be, and it fell apart. But, you know, Governor Haslam was in there, and she was going to veto it, had it reached her desk in all likelihood. So, you know, certainly knowing that a Republican was in the corner office, I think helped this thing get over the line.
That's the big difference right there. You listed the names of Governor Lynch and Governor Hassan, and that just prevented these bills from getting in earlier. And you know, it still doesn't mean the people in the pro-choice community are, you know, I think they, some of them may take issue with the governor describing himself as pro-choice for actually trying to walk this fine line, which is really why he's on a fine line.
I mean, the bill, because does, he's trying the bill to, does carve out abortion,
yes,
explicitly, but, you know, this is sort of like, a, I mean, you know, on this topic, I mean, it's sort of the equivalent of debating guns.
Exactly.
It becomes,
exactly,
you know, hard to draw lines.
It's like having the nose in the camel's tent or whatever. It's like, is it, what was the debate earlier about, you know, with Fish and Game making some kind of rules change or something, and the gun groups just kind of went, you know,
well,
after
the other thing that was interesting about this bill in particular in the debate this year was what happened in the House Criminal Justice Committee. It came over from the Senate. Initially, the House Criminal Justice Committee said that it wanted to hold on to the bill and, in fact, voted 20-1 to retain it for more work. You know, I think it was 8 or 9 days later, reverse course and, you know, flipped a couple of votes. One Republican who opposed the bill wasn't there and, you know, heads to the floor with a positive recommendation. Leadership was working this behind the scenes. You know, do you have any sense of what to make of this, Ali? Is this simply the, you know, kind of a committee kind of going native and then leadership trying to rein it in? I mean, sometimes that happens.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as we've mentioned, the stage of fetal development was a sticking point here. And, you know, some members of the committee, at least one Democrat who flipped his vote, said he actually opposed it. So before they retained it, they took a vote on the bill and it failed. And so then they decided to retain it. But one Democrat who later flipped his vote said he thought the bill at first didn't go far enough because he wanted it at conception. And then he realized that half, as he said, half a loaf is better than a full loaf. And so he moved forward. So I think it was sort of wrangling people together to start moving forward on this, even though it may not have met some of the committee members' expectations.
And Majority Leader Hinch, I interviewed him earlier in the week about the bill, and the thing he kept on repeating to me when I was asking him about it was like, it's a good Republican bill, it's a good Republican bill, it's a good Republican bill, and, you know, it's going to be signed by a Republican governor.
And I think, as we see, too, you know, we talked about the budget, Republicans fighting over that, right to work failed because of Republican infighting. You know, the House, looking at it yesterday, had a great day in terms of Republicans uniting on their priority bills, and I think this was just one example of that.
Well, another one was the bill dealing with the so-called Croydon issue, which was the decision by Croydon to send certain number of students to a Montessori school and the use of public money to send students to private schools was something that the attorney general said was not permitted. This became a big, you know, political issue. It came up in the confirmation of Education Commissioner Frank Edelblue, or actually after the confirmation when it was revealed that he had given money to Croydon Legal Defense Fund. You know, how big a deal is this? That's one thing that's been unclear to me. I mean, we don't really know what districts are going to do. But again, is this a sort of a proxy for a larger philosophical debate, Dean?
Yeah, it's absolutely a proxy for a larger philosophical debate. And as is true with the fetal homicide bill, the opposing groups believe that if they give an inch, they're going to end up eventually giving a mile on this. And, you know, we've talked before about the changing context for education policy in the country, Betsy DeVos being appointed Secretary of Education and Frank Edelblue here in New Hampshire as the head of the department. And so this is a lot of proponents of school choice see this as a long-awaited opportunity to make progress on these issues. This is, you know, maybe a small piece of that, but public school advocates believe it's a way to channel money away from the public school system and to private schools. You know, there's the argument about kind of the religious aspect of it, although religious schools are excluded from this particular bill. You know, we'll see what happens. These kinds of bills also, much like voting rights bills, often end up in the courts. But in this particular case with Croydon, there was no option, I think, after eighth grade or after sixth grade. So rather than tuitioning them to the nearest public school, parents would have the option of, or the school district would have the option of paying to send them to private school. But yeah, this is a small piece in a much larger debate. It's been around for a long, long time. The kind of school choice proponents have been on the defensive for many years, and now they finally feel like they have an opportunity both nationally and locally in New Hampshire.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it does have the potential to be a big deal, because if you think about the number of school districts in New Hampshire that don't have high schools, or in many cases they don't even have middle schools, and apparently under this bill, they would be able to tuition kids out to any school they want, as long as it's not, you know, a religious school. So I think it does.
We'll see how it plays out in practice. Yeah, it could turn into something
because it does have the potential really be a big shift in how we view these smaller school districts.
Well, as we look over Dean mentioned education as a big issue this year, and it certainly is. But if you look at the bills, as some of the other bills that are proposed, you know, the so-called freedom savings accounts was scuttled. You know, certainly we have the ongoing moves around kindergarten. You know, Allie, what do you think as we head into the end of the term, and we'll see how kindergarten resolves itself? I mean, you know, Republicans can be happy with this bill, but I mean, do you get the sense that there are some who were kind of expecting more out of this cast of characters on this in terms of loosening, you know, bureaucratic standards and giving pathways and choices, as those folks tend to like to cast this issue?
I agree that I think this Croydon bill could have a big effect, and I think lawmakers sort of felt, let's take this first step before we open it up to the freedom savings accounts. But I do think that on education, lawmakers have made in various ways a lot of changes, or are trying to make a lot of changes. I mean, even in the budget, there's a new scholarship program to give money to local students going to local colleges and tech schools. And there's a bill that would give the moratorium on school building aid is still in effect, but Governor Sununu's office would get a sizable amount of money, about $14 million is estimated right now, to distribute to districts to improve safety, technology, and take other steps. So I do think that on education they are making steps. I think the danger of rushing in really fast is that there could be a lot of opposition and a lot of pushback, and then it would flame out really fast.
There's just been so much pent-up energy among advocates for so long, because a lot of this stuff was just a non-starter at the federal level during the Obama administration. And even George W. Bush, we had No Child Left Behind, which were the federal standards that a lot of people did not like. And certainly with a series of Democratic governors here, it's been very difficult to move a lot of this stuff. And so there is this kind of pent-up energy, jump in with the savings accounts, et cetera. So this is, you know, this may be a first step, but I think that's the direction they want to move.
Yeah, I mean, eventually that's really – is. I mean, there is a big contingent of groups that really are pushing to go full bore into this whole school choice thing and really make it as open as possible. But, you know, I do think in the end, though, what's going to happen is that the individual school districts, I think, there's tensions in those districts themselves about where resources are going to go. And I think that's really where this is going to be playing out. And I think there's a debate going on in Concord, debate going on in Washington, but it's the school districts themselves, because that's the taxpayers' money. And, you know, they're the ones who
I think Allie makes a good point of raising the issue of building aid, which we've seen playing out in the backdrop of the kindergarten debate and, you know, the movement of a full-day kindergarten and, you know, local communities opting in. And, you know, several school administrators I've talked to out in communities say, well, you know, it's sort of a non-starter for us because we would need to build new schools that, you know, it's unclear if we've got the money with the suspension of building aid.
Yeah, I mean, that's had a real effect on our schools, and actually in many ways during the recession when they put this moratorium on, it was like really hurt the construction industry, which was looking for, you know, to get some help here, and you know, that the states, you know, a lot of companies had actually specialized in building schools and those kind of institutional buildings, and they have had to change their business models because of this lack of money, this tens of millions of dollars or even more of projects that are in the pipeline, you know, trying to be built but are not.
And some districts have gone ahead with
expensive
projects,
but it's not anywhere near the generosity of the old school building aid formula.
All right, coming up, more Granite State headlines on the Exchange's weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. Stick around.
Peterborough poet Becky Denison Sokolariou writes about her childhood in her new poetry collection, a time, she says, when young girls were often told what they could not do.
Looking back, I think I sabotaged that. sabotaged the directions that came at us.
I'm Peter Biello. I spoke with Sacolariu about her new collection of poetry on the bookshelf from NHPR. Subscribe to this and all of NHPR's podcasts wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Joined this week by Allie Morris of the Concord Monitor, Jeff Feingold, New Hampshire Business Review, and Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Before we leave education, I do want to sort of check in on the status of kindergarten, which remains, a ball in the air as we get through the legislative session, and one with significant interest in happening, certainly from the corner office. The House has tweaked this, attaching Keno to it, where the Keno money would flow into the Education Trust Fund. You know, out would flow $1,100 per student. This is sort of a haircut over the earlier versions that, passed the Senate and proposed by Governor Sununu. Do we have a sense of if this is the final version, or do we think this is going to change more, Allie?
No. I mean, I think once they get into a committee of conference, there'll be a lot of debate over this bill. But it is, I think, will be one of the most exciting committee of conferences to watch, because obviously, the Senate has sided, with Governor Sununu in approving kindergarten and passing that through their chamber. The House Finance Committee, I think a majority of those members actually opposed the kindergarten bill when it came around the first time, and then somewhat smartly tethered Keno to it, which is a policy that often passes the House, has never passed the Senate. They're quite averse to Keno. So it'll be interesting to see whether that aspect of it will remain in effect with kindergarten.
And it'll be interesting to see if, the governor basically praised them for doing this but didn't say anything about the Keno attachment to it, because that's a big deal, because that's where the money comes from in the House budget. And actually, theirs is more generous than the Senate's with this Keno money that they expect, isn't it?
Well, no, I don't think so. I mean, there was a version that spent, I think it was like 12 million a year, okay, or 14 million a year. Then there was a 9 million a year, the targeted one that Sununu had. And this actually drops the price a little bit. I can't give you an exact number. Mm-hmm. And the Keno money would flow. I mean, the people who don't like Keno on the House Finance Committee supported this, and they say their logic is this at least creates another avenue for money to flow into the Education Trust Fund. The Keno money is not, it becomes sort of fungible once it gets in the trust fund. It's not directly linked to kindergarten. And Allie is certainly right that the Senate has been leery of Keno, with the sort of cat out of the bag in terms of like no gambling, casino style at the moment. Perhaps that may change, but I don't get the sense that it's going to.
And just so people know what Keno is, because I certainly had no idea, I went and visited a place with Keno, and it basically you can play it in restaurants, and there's sort of screens around the parlor, and you can go up to a window and fill out cards, and it's sort of like a lottery every 5 to 10 minutes, so you can keep playing throughout the day and win prizes.
Yeah,
just to clarify.
Some people describe it as kind of like crack, because it's just constant, gambling on it, and it is. This is without a doubt the reason I think a lot of people in the Senate are against
sort of older people than
yeah,
typical.
But also, is definitely not the kind of gambling that would attract out of staters. Yeah. This is going to be New Hampshire people in bars and restaurants.
Well, in fact, one thing that a lawmaker told me, and I didn't check this, is that the largest Keno parlor in the world is apparently right over the border of Massachusetts, where the parking lot is actually in New Hampshire, I'm told. So this is something where New Hampshire has apparently been losing business, and this is something that the Lottery Commission has been suggesting, could be a real windfall for the state. I mean, they're talking, once it gets rolling, it would take a number of years for it. It's a local option, and it would take a number of years for it to be fully implemented, but it could be $10, $15, $20 million a year flowing into the Education Trust Fund, and something that would certainly be, consistent with the schools, the state's use of lottery to fund education,
That's been settled for many decades.
Well, and there's definitely energy for kindergarten in the state legislature. The governor certainly wants it. but I'm skeptical that Kino is going to be the funding source in the Senate. Maybe they'll come up with some other way to pay for targeted or this reduced amount. But I'm interested to see if that is separated off.
Well, there was a decision. There was a decision to do this outside of the budget,
right?
You know, and so we'll see what the final number ends up being. I think most people do expect it to happen. Governor Sununu, I think this is the issue. I think he's invested more sort of political capital in than any other this year. And it's something that I think that, you know, people think, you know, if he could be the first governor to get full-day kindergarten in New Hampshire, that would not be a bad way to run for re-election.
Oh, so absolutely.
I think he's well aware of that.
I think he knows that. And you know, and as we said, that's something that people can wrap their heads around, is having kindergarten as opposed to, you know, this budget, which is just this abstract idea.
All right. Tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at NHPR or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Joined this week by Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University, Allie Morris, Concord Monitor, Jeff Feingold, New Hampshire Business Review. You know, another bill that has the possibility of being, you know, what people tend to call legacy issue for Governor Sununu is marijuana decriminalization. That's headed to his desk. Has it arrived yet, Allie? Do we know?
I mean, no. It's, it was just concurred on yesterday.
Okay, so
it'll be a few
that'll
weeks.
Be to his desk in a few days. He said he's going to sign on to this. That would mean that marijuana, up to 3/4 of an ounce, will be decriminalized by, you know, halfway through August. You know, ho hum, or something that that voters care about and that makes life easier for law enforcement. You know, we'll see. So, but this is something that I don't think, you know, I think this is another thing that, you know, you have to sort of give Governor Sununu credit for this result. Had Governor Hassan been around for another term, she certainly
was not a friend of it.
Not a friend of it.
Yeah. So now under this bill, when you legally purchase your marijuana in Maine or Massachusetts and you get stopped in New Hampshire, you're only going to have to pay $100 fine instead of do a potentially a year in jail. You know, the attitudes, the sort of public attitudes on decriminalization, legalization have changed so dramatically in the last 10 years. It's, you know, someone who's been covering politics, certainly like Jeff, for many years. You know, I remember a time when if you even admitted you tried marijuana, you either didn't inhale or it basically was the end of your political career. Yeah. So it's just amazing how far we've come in several decades. So, you know, will this take I'll be interested to see whether this kind of takes the sort of immediate pressure off the push for legalization, or if this combined with Maine and Massachusetts sort of speeds things up even more.
Well, I think that is really what a lot of this pressure is coming from. It's from around the borders of the state, because Vermont's also been thinking.
We'll see what they end up.
In Vermont, the governor vetoed it, but they're still in some kind of discussions. And also, we're talking about in Canada. Also, so you have all around us all the neighbors will either have it or eventually will have legalized marijuana. And I would think, you know, New Hampshire has a tourism state. We have a big tourism industry. That does raise some issues about, you know, we're going to say you can come, but leave your pot at the border or whatever, or we'll cover your fine if you stay at our hotel. I mean, what's going to happen there?
New Hampshire liquor and cannabis outlets on the interstate.
All right. Well, sticking with matters that touch on the criminal for a minute, let's talk about two developments involving people in New Hampshire politics. One is New Hampshire House Member Tom Catsantonis, a Manchester Democrat, charged with, you know, pretty significant tax evasion, Jeff. You know, and this is on the rooms and meals tax.
Yeah, it was about $425,000 that apparently he collected at his pizza. He had a pizzeria and a bar. He collected this money over a period of many years and didn't send it to the state. You know, this is how the state gets its one of its biggest revenue raisers is the rooms and meals tax. And he just was pocketing it, apparently, allegedly. And that's a lot of money. If you remember a few months ago, they came to his place and took about a bunch of records out and put a lien on his property for about the same amount of money. And I think we knew this was coming down the road, apparently. But this is a big. I haven't heard of this one like this in a long, long time. This kind of skimming of rooms and meals tax.
Well, and this is someone who also is involved in city politics in Manchester, and
He's very, very well known in Manchester, and you know he's been a state rep. It's really It's like kind of mind blowing to think that he apparently has been doing this, or allegedly has been doing this over this period of years, while actually working on policy issues at the state and local level.
I mean, it's a lot of money. There's no doubt about that. And I guess we'll see where this goes. You know, the predictable partisan response. You know, Republicans calling for him to resign. You know, we'll see what happens there. You know, another development involving somebody. You know, his wife was in the House. He was never in the House. Is Jerry DeLamis, big Tea Party activist, co-chair of Donald Trump's New Hampshire Veterans Coalition during the campaign. Somebody I've interviewed many times, involved out in the Bundy Ranch standoff. The first person sentenced out of that, and you know, a pretty significant sentence, 87 months and above what prosecutors had recommended. What do you make of that, Dean?
Well, yeah, this is something that we've watched develop for some time now. You know, from my understanding from the reporting is that he tried to withdraw his plea at one point, and that the judge actually said that kind of hurt his cause. You know, I think they've been hoping for a slightly smaller sentence. There are a number of other people. This was the argument over the Bundy Ranch. It's the Southwest. I can't remember
which
in Nevada, where they hadn't paid federal grazing fees for like 20 years, and so federal government said either pay up or we're going to take your cattle. And so DeLamis went to the joined them, armed, set up patrols, things like that.
I mean, there are pictures of him on Facebook with these very significant. This one long rifle cocked on his hip that. It was, you know, definitely military style, and people wearing fatigues, and you know, there were rallies when he was charged at the federal court. Yeah. I mean, there were rallies outside the court where members of the legislature, some of them, and conservative activists were there saying essentially, you know, Jerry's a good guy. Yeah. You know, you've got it wrong. And this followed some of the other incident involving Bundy folks in Oregon were acquitted. You know, at that point, he tried to withdraw a guilty plea. You know, there's been talk that, you know, he might seek a pardon from President Trump. You know, I guess we'll stay tuned on that one. But
well, the thing is that it's interesting because the prosecution did ask for a lesser sentence than the judge gave, and she called him a bully vigilante. She was not impressed with him, and he tried
to make the case that the being armed was only for defensive purposes, and that he would not have shot at federal law enforcement officials. And I guess the judge did not find that persuasive.
And also, apparently, she was also upset that he didn't show any remorse for what happened. He just kind of justified what he did, and basically that he's the victim, and which is a lot of his supporters in New Hampshire think of him as being the victim. You know, his wife and Jack Kimble, who's a former
GOP chairman. Yeah. Before we wrap up this week, I do want to talk about this story kind of broke a lot over the weekend, or changed a lot over the weekend, which is Governor Sununu's intercession on behalf of rogue bears in Hanover. And you know, the plan for Fish and Game was these bears had become used to eating garbage and kind of making the scene in a neighborhood, and that Fish and Game said, you know, the result would have to be these bears would have to be euthanized. Governor Sununu said that wasn't going to happen, and now it's not happening. And, you know, the bears were, at least the cubs were relocated to Pittsburgh, I believe, and the mother is thought to be off in the woods seeking a mate. You know, the politics of this is interesting because you looked at Twitter on this and you had people, you know, vehement on this, and you had, North Country State Senator Jeff Woodburn saying, you know, Governor Sununu, let Fish and Game make these calls. What do you think this
means? You heard the initial response from Fish and Game. They said, well, this is our policy. You know, I don't care who's telling us what to do. But apparently there must have been a few phone calls or something.
Well, and apparently a petition of thousands of people.
Yeah, I think in particular the governor's involvement really just gave this really some momentum to change their tune on euthanizing the bears.
Well, I mean, of course, everyone hopes for the best as far as the outcome on this. Why don't we listen to what Ben Killam, who lives in Lyme, he's an expert in bears and has helped bears recuperate infant bears. Why don't we just take a listen to what he said about this whole thing?
Home is home, and, you know, they tend to come back. And the only effective way of managing bear problems are to manage people. If that doesn't happen, this whole cycle is going to take place all over again.
All right. Well, you know, let's hope in this case he's wrong. But I mean, that seems to be the consensus, is that human behavior and, you know, officials exactly. in Hanover had said, you know, trash being out, college students with greasy grills, bird feeders galore, all these things have created a situation yes. where bears well, prowl.
And I remember 2 years ago I covered a story where there was a rash of bear shootings and orphan cubs because they kept getting into people's chicken coops and people yeah. were shooting them. So it is a long-standing problem.
The power of yeah. social media. I mean, I read the initial report where the fish and game official said, we're going to euthanize them and then we'll shoot them. And as soon as I read that, I thought, okay, that's going to go viral and this yeah. is going to blow up and something else is going to happen, because it's just, you know, people started weighing in from all over the country yep. and sure enough, the governor
and
stepped
also,
in.
And also apparently the bear population in New Hampshire is growing, and this is just something that's going to happen more frequently in more you know, populated areas. And
but I mean, you know, certainly politically, like, I mean, everyone hopes these bears go in the woods and stay in the woods, but you know, heaven forbid if something bad happened with this bear showing up and
this is a problem
doing harm to somebody or something. And I was talking to somebody on the elevator in this building who invoked this, and you know, a mild-mannered person who sometimes talks politics with me on the elevator, and was just, you know, turned to me and said, there's a lot of woods in Waterville. Why didn't the governor want to send them there? And so, you know, this is the kind of story that affects people. And, you know, maybe Governor Sununu will be a political beneficiary of, you know, people's predisposition to like pictures of cute bears. But this is a state where lots of bears are killed by hunters yeah, all the time.
And that's to manage the population so that they don't have these kind of human interactions.
I assume they were sedated, so maybe they're tagged or some way that they can track these bears in the future to
see. So if we know these bears
grow
back.
Up, right.
There's no DCYF for bears or anything?
No, that'll be the next political scandal.
Yeah. All right. We're almost out of time. You know, it's a busy and murky, kind of swampy time of year at the State House where things,
air conditioning.
So what are you going to be watching, Allie, as we kind of get out of the year, at least hopefully, and have everyone head home for the summer?
I will. Once we get out of the legislature, well, I'll be consumed with the budget yeah. at least next week, looking to see who's on the committee of conference and how that kind of plays out and whether we may have a summer at the legislature because we can't get a budget passed.
I just wanted to give a shout out to NH Gives Day, which is June 6th and 7th. NHGives.org, it's like a big deal, like hundreds of nonprofits in the state try to raise money. And this is the second year they're doing it, and I think it's just something for people to think about. I know we're on a nonprofit right now, but
all right, Dean.
Yeah, also watching the budget as well, and always keeping an eye on our congressional delegation. They were all very outspoken in the last 24 hours over President Trump withdrawing from the Paris Climate Agreement.
Okay, and for those interested in continuing the discussion on bears, the exchange will be covering human-bear conflict on Tuesday. Interesting to see. You know, what people make of this and whether this is an issue that that comes back, as you know, Ben Killam says the bears are going to be back. So thanks a lot, everyone. I'm Josh Rogers. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Have a good week.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.